them while their case proceeds. Ken Connolly is one of the attorneys for the pro-life centers.
These pro-life pregnancy centers exist to help women choose life for their babies. Yet Hawaii is trying to force them to essentially advertise for abortion. That's not only wrong, it's unconstitutional under both the free speech and free exercise clauses of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution.
The pro-life pregnancy care centers are being forced to direct women to state agencies that provide referrals for abortion funding. I'm John Clemens.
Anytime you want to know the latest news, find it out from us online at usaradio.com.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hutterton Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hutterton-chamber.org.
Well, good afternoon on this beautiful, and I mean beautiful, gorgeous, sunny afternoon, and I guess we're supposed to have good weather for the weekend. Why don't we find out? And let's see what we're predicting. Well, tonight it's supposed to be partly cloudy, low of about 58 degrees. Tomorrow, beautiful day, sunny, high of 86 degrees, and again on Sunday, actually, it could be 90 degrees on Sunday. So this should be one last great time to go to the shore. I still have trouble saying shore rather than beach, but that's, I know, in the East Coast in New Jersey, it's the shore. And I guess the good thing is that there are no fees on any of the beaches. As of, I think it's Labor Day, that that's the end of the fees. Some of the places where there's parking were there's no parking fees. Of course, the thing you have to be very careful about is there also aren't any lifeguards. So just, if in fact, be very careful. If you're at the shore and you go into the water, remember the riptides can be very dangerous. And one of the things that all of my children and even grandchildren know, that if in fact you get into a riptide, don't fight it. Try to swim parallel to the shore, because if you try to fight it, you'll get pulled out and pulled under. Usually, if you can not panic and swim parallel to the shore, you'll be fine, because there'll be a sandbar and you'll be able to stand up very shortly. But don't let children go in the water without really strict supervision, because they will, in fact, not understand exactly how they can get out of a riptide. So that wasn't what I was planning on saying today, but with the beautiful weather at the shore and in New Jersey, there'll be many things to do this weekend, and I'm sure that one of them will be people going to the shore. Not quite time to travel around the state to look at the leaves, although they are turning. Our mountain is turning, so that, and what's always interesting to me is that the valley turns before the mountain. You would think that the trees on the mountain would turn first. At least I thought so, but that's not the case. So in any event, let me bring you one other spot from our sponsors, and then we'll get on with the program. It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits. And by the way, those of you who are interested in what's happening on Monday, a good day to take off. Because, again, it should be sunny and high of about 90 degrees. Now, of course, our weather here is not exactly what the weather is at the shore, but it doesn't appear, at least on the weather prediction now that we're going to have any of the storms that we could expect from the hurricanes. And by Tuesday, again, partly sunny and really unseasonably warm, 90 to 93 degrees. Actually, by Tuesday, it may drop by about 10 degrees. So let me bring you one more spot from our sponsors while I try to get organized, and then we'll be back with It's the Law.
Join the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce and the Flemington Community Partnership for their Card Club networking event hosted by Northfield Bank on Thursday, September 28th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Northfield Bank's Flemington office right here on Main Street. For details and to RSVP, visit hunterdon-chamber.org or call 908-782-7115. See you there.
Well, hello again. I'm Pat Smits, host of It's the Law, and it's a few minutes after 4 o'clock, so that's the program. And what are we doing today? Well, I wanted to remind a few people, those of us who either procrastinate or are really too busy and have legitimate excuses not to file our income tax returns. Remember, the absolute deadline to file this year is Monday, October 16th, and that's right around the corner, especially if you have not met with your accountant or been able to get all of your documents together. It is extremely important that you file, and I think sometimes I've had clients who say, well, I don't have the money to pay, so I'm not going to file until I have the money. Wrong. Just file the tax returns and then start making the payments. Yes, there's going to be interest and there will be penalties, but it will be much more expensive if you wait, the longer you wait. The other thing I wanted to remind people, and this is a reminder that I received from Cal Barson. Cal is an accountant in Somerville. He usually does forensic work, and his firm does other work. But he reminded us that certain people can get 14 days tax-free income. Well, obviously that seems too good to be true, but it's one of those tax odysseys that we have. And I shouldn't say odysseys, I guess it would be oddities. And it really is a pretty good deal. And who benefits? Well, if you have property, second property, or even your home, for that matter, although you have different deductions for the home. So really, this is for people who have property maybe at the shore or a vacation home somewhere else. Some of the snowbirds, for example, who have property in Florida or Arizona or anywhere, and then, you know, stay there in the winter and come back north to get out of the heat in the summer. If, in fact, you rent it, and you can rent it for 14 days or less, and if you do that, the rental income is tax-free. According to Cal, you don't have to report it, and if you don't report it on the federal tax return, I don't believe you have to report it on the state New Jersey taxes. So what does that mean? If, in fact, you rent, and it's the important thing is 14 days, because if you cross that line and even rent for 15 days or 16 days, then everything, your entire amount of the rental income is subject to tax. And then, of course, you would also, in that case, fill out the Schedule E on your tax return, and you'd be able to claim appropriate related expenses. But be very careful not to get too greedy. It can be problematic if you, year after year, take losses on that rental property, especially if you're using it a significant portion of the time. But in any event, the benefit is intended for those who might, on occasion, rent out for 1 or 2 weeks, and usually that's their vacation home. And the concept is that if that is all you are doing, you shouldn't be burdened with the various record keeping and documentation rules that you need to adhere to if, in fact, you're renting for more than 14 days. And if you're reporting income, there are a lot of documents that you have to maintain related to expenses, and then even allocating the property between personal and rental use. Now, interestingly, my question was, well, what happens with people who are this Airbnb? And I didn't know it for a long time. It's actually spelled A-I-R-B-N-B. So what is happening is many people around the country are grabbing a little extra rental income by renting out a room or portion of their home on a temporary basis, sometimes just one night or two nights or a weekend. However, that 14-day limit applies, and it's going to be interesting to see if the IRS starts cracking down on Airbnb homeowners who are renting out. But in any event, that's a tax break just for those of you who are, in fact, renting out properties for a short period of time. So that one of the things that those of us who don't file our taxes have to remember is that we better get going. And one of the questions my clients often ask is, well, I think our income is higher than the wages and salaries that are reported on line 7. Well, that's probably true. And remember, I handle divorce cases. My practice, I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County, but my practice is limited to divorce cases. And I represent about half of my clients are men and half of my clients are women. So it often comes up that I am representing the spouse who is not financially astute. And don't believe it's always the women, because that's not the case. But in any event, the wages, salaries, and tips reported on line 7 will reflect, and I'm talking about your federal tax return, the 1040, and they will reflect federal taxable wages only. And your federal taxable wages do not include 401k deferrals or Section 125 cafeteria plan deferrals or other qualified medical savings plans. So what someone needs to do to find out what the total gross, not the reportable gross, but the total gross is look at the box that talks about Medicare wages. And then, at least for divorce cases, we utilize the Medicare wages as the gross wages. So, of course, other people, depending, it's very important to take a look, if you're really concerned, is the Schedule B, because that must be filled in if interest or dividends exceed $1,500. And that would include, the Schedule B includes interest from bank accounts, brokerage accounts, loans receivable, and also some flow-through interest from various entities, including general and limited partnerships, limited liability companies, subchapter S corporations, and trusts. And then it would also include tax-free interest. So those are very important to take a look, at least for people who are going through divorce. It means that, you know, if they didn't know about certain accounts, they should be listed in the Schedule B, and especially important to list all the accounts, because that's something that the IRS very easily comes back if you have not listed all of your interest income. So then, of course, the dividends also include dividends from a number of sources, and, of course, interest and dividends are different, but, again, from bank accounts, brokerage accounts, stocks, and the flow-through dividends from the entities that I just talked about and the tax-free dividends. Now, I guess while I'm talking about tax returns, the other question that I often receive phone calls about is alimony. Does someone who is receiving alimony have to include the alimony in their taxes? And there are a few things that, whether it's alimony or not, what attorneys should do and litigants should do is really make sure if, in fact, they intend money not to be taxable alimony, they need to put that in their agreement. Because, in fact, people can agree that money paid for support from one spouse to the other is non-taxable alimony. And the other thing is that child support is never includable in a tax return. In other words, the parent who is receiving child support from the other parent does not include the child support in his or her income tax return. And the parent who pays child support cannot, and I emphasize this a lot, cannot deduct child support. It is a non-deductible, and what we call non-deductible and non-includable. Very important. And as I said, it's important that the alimony that the one spouse claims and the alimony that the claims to have received and the alimony that the other spouse claims to have paid match up. And this becomes interesting at the end of the year because, remember, since most of us are calendar year taxpayers, it would include the alimony that someone pays, the payor would include all the alimony he or she pays from January 1st of the year, let's say January 1st, 2017, until December 31st of 2017. Now, interestingly, the recipient who may get that December 31st payment the following year does not have to report it until the following year. So there can be a small discrepancy. I don't know of anyone who's ever had the IRS come back for a small discrepancy. But this is significant because the tax savings to a payor can be fairly significant depending on his or her income and the amount of alimony. Now, remember, I am saying his or her because, contrary to what many women think, women do pay alimony to their male spouses, former male spouses. So the traditional situation that we think about is that the husband, former husband, is paying alimony to the former wife. Not always the case. Now, the business income, of course, and that's very important for someone who has a business, and they, if it's a sole proprietorship, that means that it is Schedule C income. It's on, of course, it's listed on the 1040 form, and in fact, it's listed on business income as line 12. So that's where the business income or loss is reported, and it is calculated under your Schedule C. Also, of course, line 13, if there's any capital gains or losses, that's and that's, you know, can be required and may not have to be required. But it's always important to fill out a Schedule D if you need to. And then important is line 17, the rental, real estate, royalties, partnerships, S-corps, trusts, and that's all Schedule E income. And as I said, when I started this, if you're renting out your vacation home for 14 days or less, you do not have to report that income. I think unemployment and their Social Security, that is not necessarily, well, it is not all 100% taxable. It depends, and you have to be very careful with that. You have to report Social Security benefits on line 20A, and then, of course, B is the taxable amount. So the taxable amount is the amount that you must report. Another thing that, of course, must be reported is retirement income. And there is a line, of course, 15A for IRA distributions, including the taxable amount, and 16A for pensions and annuities and the taxable amount. And it is necessary after people reach the age of 71 and a half, there is a mandatory amount that you have to withdraw from the IRA and from pension and 401k plans. Again, that's very important. There are some significant penalties if that's not done. Well, I guess we're moving right along here. Didn't mean to take quite that much time on taxes, but from a legal standpoint, it is very important. And the other thing that I'd like to say, is for people who own businesses and both spouses work in the business, I always am amazed that they will decide that one spouse works without getting paid on the books. In other words, if one person owns the business, let's say husband owns the business, but wife works there, I don't understand why someone wants to save the taxes, the Social Security taxes, by not claiming and giving the spouse a W-2 and paying the necessary Social Security taxes. Because, you know, there are always exceptions, but it is really important, in my view, and this usually happens with women, that I will see women who have worked their entire career in a spouse's business, but they've never been paid, on the books. Well, this means that they have no right, if they haven't worked, they won't have any right to get Social Security in their name. Or even if they might have worked at some other jobs, they're going to get very minimal Social Security, when in fact they could possibly even have maximized the amount of Social Security. So that I think for everyone this is important. But as I said, in a divorce case, either the spouse, the dependent spouse, or the spouse who has less income can in fact get Social Security benefits. They can get half of their spouse's benefit at retirement, their former spouse, I guess I should say, if in fact that will be more than their own Social Security. But for most people, that's not a win-win situation. So why don't we talk a little bit about some of our sponsors, or let them talk about themselves, and then we'll be back shortly.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Music. This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location, Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington from 2 to 7 p.m. If you're a business or organization and would like to participate, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at huntertonchamber.org.
Well, we're back. It's the law, and the program is It's the Law. And thanks to our sponsors. And please, if you've never been at a chamber expo, it is really fun. You'll see a lot of folks that you know. You'll see a lot of businesses, and it's a great way to support our local businesses here in Hunterdon. We're still lucky to have so many of them. And great food, the restaurants. I've really been able to experience restaurants that I had not been aware of until they came to the chamber. The other thing I did want to mention today, and I plan, if possible, to have a guest next week, and I'd like to talk about, or I plan on talking about, the New Jersey statute, which deals with the right of adoptees to obtain information about their birth parents. And I know this has been very controversial, but in fact, in January of this year, adoptees in the state, in New Jersey, gained legal access to their birth records for the first time. And then apparently, as of mid-August, more than 3,500 had received their original birth certificates from the state. So what happens, and I'll talk more about this next week. In fact, I hope to have a guest. But what happens is after requesting the information, they will get it unless the adoptive parent, unless the birth parent has notified the state that they don't want the information released. So I think this is an important statute. If you know of anyone who is adopted and is interested in this information, I hope they will tune in because this has been a fight that has been fought over many, many years, whether or not the right of an adoptee, whether they have the right to obtain that information, or whether or not the birth parent had the right when they, as a result of giving up the child, baby, child for adoption, has a right to have their privacy protected. Interesting dilemma, and I do have my own personal views because one of the things that I think one of the best reasons for allowing those records to be opened is the fact that very often there are medical reasons to need to find out about your background, your actual genetic background. But we'll talk more about that next week. So what's happening in, the cases and what's approved for publication and not, as people know who listen to this program, the only cases that are what we call precedent setting are cases that have been approved for publication. Now, all of the New Jersey Supreme Court cases are approved for publication, I should say, are published. Many of the appellate division cases are not approved for publication. In fact, I feel that more of them should be approved because they're very helpful. And what that means to those of us, especially the family law cases that are not approved for publication, means that we can't argue that they're precedent. And they have no binding effect on a trial judge. The other cases that are, in fact, published do have binding effect on a trial judge who's dealing with the same issues. Now, there are, in fact, we desperately miss Judge Jones, who has been a judge, and he decided to retire early. He was publishing a number of decisions. Many of them are published. So that the interesting issue there is if Judge Jones had a case and made a decision, even if his decision was published, it's not binding on other trial judges. So what with that, there are some consolidated appeals, and these were Bed Bath & Beyond appeals, the final agency decision of the Treasury Department's unclaimed property administration that denied Bed Bath & Beyond's claim for a refund of the value of certain unclaimed merchandise return certificates. And then in a second case, they appealed the denial of a similar refund claim. So what does this mean? Well, in the first case, the court reversed the UPA's denial because Bed Bath & Beyond was not required by New Jersey's Uniform Unclaimed Property Act to remit these unclaimed certificates. And in the second case, the court reversed for other reasons, concluding that the certificates constituted stored value cards within the meaning of UUPA. Now, frankly, it seems a little bit Greek to me, so probably the same to you. What we know is that Bed Bath & Beyond lost. And other than that, as far as today, that was the only case that was actually published. So one of the other things in the news, of course, is the Menendez trial. That's the jurors in the corruption trial of U.S. Senator Bob Menendez heard on Wednesday about flights that Menendez took at the expense of co-defendant Solomon Melgen. And then the proceedings returned to a central theme in the case, and that is the two men's friendship and its relevance as defense to bribery charges. So that, another black eye in New Jersey, that we have a senator, a sitting senator, who's on trial. And I know that the case was, without making comment on whether there's guilt or innocence here, it's just unfortunate that there would even be enough evidence to bring a U.S. senator to trial. All the parents who have kids have heard about the Toys R Us bankruptcy. And, not only is there speculation, but there's really disbelief that Toys R Us, which is the largest toy store chain in the United States, and also home of Jeffrey the Giraffe, who I guess is an important character, but they officially filed bankruptcy late Monday in Richmond, Virginia. So this, I think everybody thought that was a very strong company, and so whatever the reasons, we'll certainly find out. We'll certainly find out if there's going to be reorganization, closing of stores, etc. But what we do know now is that Toys R Us officially filed bankruptcy on Monday. And we'll be hearing more and more about that case. Now, also, not that I know anything about it, because I don't, but apparently New Jersey is a popular venue for filing patent infringement lawsuits. And, and I guess I should know why, and that is as the medicine chest of the world. That's what we're known as, comprising thousands of pharmaceutical, biopharmaceutical, biotechnology, medical technology, medical device, and diagnostic companies. The District of New Jersey is the logical form for many life science patent suits. And I'm certainly not going to go into patent suits because I'm, something that certainly you won't find lawyers and probably I don't know if any patent lawyers in Hunterdon County. I'm sure there are some, and I'll be hearing about this. But, in fact, this is a very specialized field, and patent lawyers handle patents. So the there was a family law case approved, and this was an appellate division case, and its initials, LC versus MAJ. And the issue in this case is on the day of the final hearing, the defendant filed an in limine motion that sought dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint. And the defendant argued that the alleged facts suggested only parenting differences and not domestic violence. So what happened is the trial judge considered and granted the motion without taking testimony or providing the plaintiff a full and fair opportunity to meaningfully respond. Okay. Well, you kind of know what's going to happen at the appellate division. In condemning the filing of an in limine motions that seek disposition of an action, the appellate division said, particularly in domestic violence actions, and in finding the motion's rapid consideration and disposition deprived the plaintiff of due process, the court reversed and remanded for a final hearing. So what what the appellate division does is send cases back. And in this case, they said that the trial judge should not have granted the in limine motion, but in fact should have had a final hearing. So important case in family, although rarely this would come up as far as filing an in limine motion based on the fact that in this case, the defendant said that they were just not domestic violence, but parenting differences. So the lawyers suing over the Equifax data breach have turned to the Fair Credit Reporting Act, a statute that credit reporting agency had lobbied over to bring class actions on. Actually, the credit agency had lobbied. They don't want to be held to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. In any event, there are 143 million potential victims. If, in fact, you're one of them, the question is, for all of us, what action do we take now, if any action? And I can't even, I wouldn't make a recommendation from a legal standpoint, but don't even know myself what to do from a personal standpoint. I'm waiting to see how all of this turns out. And, of course, if we have any identity theft, I think what this is going to do is really escalate the number of people who get themselves covered for identity theft. And there are companies out there that provide that protection, of course, at a cost. So maybe their stock will go up, and probably their fees will also go up. Now, there would be questions here because there is a pelvic mesh mass tort litigation, and the judge overseeing that litigation said the New Jersey-based defendant may have had a strong relationship with a Pennsylvania mesh manufacturer, but the judge questioned whether that relationship would be enough to allow the Keystone State to retain jurisdiction over 90 pelvic mesh cases. So, again, very sophisticated litigation that's going on. There was Morris County, a woman who suffered severe back pain after a vehicle collided with a police car, and she received a $2.6 million settlement in her Morris County lawsuit against the Mount Olive Police Department. And, for most of us, we wouldn't want to have the kind of pain associated with getting that type of
settlement. At least I wouldn't. Okay, so what else is happening? Well, let me at least give you a little bit more information. There is a real estate civil procedure contracts case that was reported this week. Actually, I think this one was reported last week. But in any event, I was not here last week, so I'll talk to you about that. And this was a construction defect cause of action. And what the judges found, and this is a Supreme Court decision written by Justice Albin, and the cause of action accrues at the time that the building's original or subsequent owners first knew or through the exercise of reasonable diligence should have known the basis for a claim. So that when we talk about statute of limitations, that is important. When someone knew, and if they only knew more recently, especially after a statute of limitations might have passed, whether they did what they needed to do with reasonable diligence would have found out. So in this type of case, the plaintiff, the person bringing suit, has 6 years to file a claim. Now, what the court said, however, is that a subsequent owner stands in no better position than a prior owner in calculating the limitations period. So if a prior owner knew or reasonably should have known of a basis for a construction defect action, the limitations period began at that point. So in this particular case, the Supreme Court cannot determine when the accrual clock commenced for each defendant based on the record before it, and therefore remanded the case to the trial court. So in other words, if there was a construction defect cause of action and you buy property from the prior owner, if that owner knew or through the exercise of reasonable diligence should have known about the defect, you could be barred from suing, not the prior owner. That would be different if, in fact, they knew or should have known. However, you would not be able to sue whoever caused the construction defect. So that is a pretty significant case where obviously what it means is anyone, especially a larger built, well, not just commercial, but anyone should do their due diligence if they feel or if there could be a problem. And one of the things that I hear often, I have a good friend who is an excellent, not an appraiser, but he goes into, I'm losing the term. He's a private inspector. In other words, you hire him, if you're buying a property, you hire him to do the inspection to determine whether or not there are any defects, and he will come up and with a report. And a very practical, great guy. And, of course, one of the things that amazes me sometimes, and I don't do real estate, I don't handle real estate, but it is interesting sometimes where people will buy an older house and they would expect that it was in perfect condition as if it was built yesterday. So some of the obsolescence, obviously, is to be expected, but we're talking about real defects and defects in the construction. And that is what an inspector looks for and gives you a report of what there is. Now, the fact that it's a 10-year-old house and has a 10-year-old dishwasher, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the house. It just means that there's a 10-year-old dishwasher and you may have to replace it now or shortly. So the Let's see what else we have that are might be of interest. The Third Circuit has overturned the dismissal of two antitrust suits over reverse settlements in which the patent holders sought to delay the sale of generic versions of blockbuster drugs, so that that has a significant impact on people who want to use generic drugs, and for a certain period of time, of course, the makers of the drugs are in fact protected, and for reason because they have probably spent a lot of money over the years trying to test the drugs and get it to market, and so they want to hold on to their right to not allow generic people to come in and just put out the generic drug. Well, and that's, it'd be interesting to have doctors and other medical people, because one of the things that I have seen is that the insurance companies, of course, really push for people whenever there are genetic drugs available for the to get them. And I certainly know that sometimes, and I've seen this personally, where doctors have to fight to get the brand name drug, which they believe is significantly different, or at least different enough that they want their patient to take the generic, not take the generic drug. So let me come back in a couple minutes after I let you know something more about some more of our sponsors.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hey, Big C here, doing a little practicing for the Hunterdon County Chamber's 16th Annual Golf Classic. We're teeing off at Tuesday, October 3rd at Hawk Point Golf Club. The signature sponsor this year is Hunterdon Healthcare. Besides enjoying a great game of golf, this event is an excellent way for you to promote your business via our sponsorship opportunities, silent auction, and networking luncheon. The Golf Classic launches at 8:30 a.m. with registration, breakfast, and a putting warm-up. This scramble format will begin with a shotgun start at 10 a.m. Plus, we will have some exciting contests to enjoy throughout the day. Oh yes, the winning foursome will be presented with the fabulous Hunterdon Cup. Talk about bragging rights. I got you this year, Team ExxonMobil. I'll see you on the first tee.
Okay, we're back for the last few minutes of the program. And there is one of the things that seems almost to be a trend lately is what's happening with foreclosure suits. Now, there's a case that some people might be interested in reading if you're concerned about possible foreclosure. And it was not approved for publication. It's an appellate division case, U.S. Bank Trust versus Thomas. I believe it was published on the 21st of September, and meaning it wasn't published, but it was reported. So it's an unpublished case that you can get a copy of the opinion, but it's not precedent setting. But in this case, the defendants appealed the denial of their motion to vacate a default and dismiss the complaint in a mortgage foreclosure. This was First Bank filed a foreclosure complaint and assigned the mortgage to a Delaware trust, which substituted itself as a plaintiff. So we had First Bank, a bank here, and then Delaware Trust, U.S. Bank Trust, was substituted as a plaintiff. So the trial court rejected the defendant's argument that the trust lacked standing to foreclose and entered summary judgment in favor of the trust. And the defendants moved to dismiss, arguing that the trust was a corporation under the Recording Act and, as a result of that, was required to file a business activities report. They obviously had a good lawyer. So the trial court agreed and stayed the defendant's motion and required the trust to submit proof that it filed the report. And then that action was dismissed by stipulation of the parties. So then the trust assigned the mortgage to a second bank, which filed the present foreclosure action. And the defendants in the second action filed a motion to dismiss. And in that case, the trial court entered a default against the defendants. Then the defendants, of course, moved to vacate, arguing the bank was precluded from bringing a new action until the trust fulfilled its reporting requirements. So now, it was interesting because they don't explain, and I have to go into depth and read the case to see if I understand why the action was dismissed by stipulation of the parties. In other words, the whole case apparently was not dismissed. It was just when the defendants asked to require the trust to submit proof that it filed a report, that action was dismissed by stipulation. And then, of course, the trust, as would have been expected, would assign the mortgage to a second bank, which filed a foreclosure action. So then the issue is whether or not the trust still had to provide proof of the report. So the trial court agreed with the bank that as a federally chartered national banking association, it was exempt from the filing requirement of the Reporting Act. And the defendants argued that the bank could not maintain its action until its assignor, meaning the trust assigned their rights to this bank who filed the second foreclosure action. But they argued that the bank could not maintain its action until the trust filed the required report. And the appellate division found that the Reporting Act did not apply to foreign banks filing foreclosure actions in New Jersey. So in this case, the appellate division said that they meaning that they didn't even have to, did not apply, did not have to, that reporting act didn't apply to them. It would only apply if they were New Jersey, a trust in New Jersey. So that there are so many often, and the part of the problem is that sometimes the banks will refuse to take mortgage payments while a foreclosure action is pending, and you know, they don't have to do it, which creates more problems because there are people who might have some legitimate reasons why they didn't make a payment, and when the bank doesn't make a payment and then holds off, they may not have paid a mortgage for 6 months, a year, or even longer. So that, you know, then the courts will say, well, you know, you didn't pay your mortgage, so therefore it's going to be foreclosed. There is a lot of action now, or I guess I should say reaction, to the Bisbing decision. And that was the decision where the New Jersey Supreme Court changed the reasons, or I should say changed the standard. It's actually changing the standard as to when a custodial parent can move out of state. And I think it's a recognition that custodial parents looking to move out of New Jersey will have a difficult hill to climb if their former spouses object to the move. And it will, of course, be based now on best interest of the child. So even if the move is involves a better job or a new spouse, that won't necessarily permit the parent who has primary residential custody from easily being able to move. And now the fact that and what the Bauer standard, the prior standard, made it very easy for the parent who had primary residence to move. Many attorneys, and I was included in one of them, felt that it was too easy. Almost any excuse with some judges would permit the move of a child. And this is a really critical issue. Now, under the Bisbing case, even if one parent is a parent of primary residence, the issue is the best interest of the child when parties have joint legal custody. And in most cases now, parents do have joint legal custody. There's pressure to name one parent as a parent of primary residence, although I have a number of cases that I've settled where the parents have equal time. The way they arrange it is the children spend equal time with each parent, and neither parent is named the parent of primary residence, because now that's not significant. Before it was significant because it was fairly easy for the parent of primary residence to move out of state because the focus was on the parent, both parents, but really on the parent who wanted to move. So now there was a another fairly a significant jury award in Sussex County where a woman who was injured in a rear-end accident received $1.8 million verdict in Sussex County. That was a jury award. And the reason I say these things is, you know, Hunterdon and Warren, Somerset, even Morris and certainly Sussex are not known to give big awards. Certainly, you know, jurors or juries in some of the more populated counties seem to come up with higher awards. And, of course, the insurance companies know that, so that they take that into consideration when they're offering settlements. So there was another, not good news for lawyers because there was an attorney sentenced to 8 years in jail in a mortgage fraud scheme. What's really unfortunate is, well, it's unfortunate it was an attorney, but it was a woman attorney who stole $873,000, more than that, from a lender by using forged identities to file fraudulent mortgage applications. And then we have the U.S. versus Paulson, and in that it was a Third Circuit case, and the defendant appealed from two aspects of his judgment of sentence, arguing that the district court erred in calculating the number of victims who suffered a substantial financial